All right, everybody, ready to go? Yes, you're settled. You're happy with the service and everything, yeah?
Absolutely.
Everything's good, man, good man, good man. You're looking forward to the lads, yeah? We have Steve McMahon back again to chat about Liverpool's season. We got some Tottenham fans in the house, right up. Oh, they're all in the front row these days. Something to be singing about. A Chelsea fan. Where are we? Undecided, undecided so far. We'll chat about that in a few minutes. We'll give you a chance as well to ask some questions to the lads before the end of this. But we do have two proper Irish legends to come now. Almost 700 Premier League appearances between them. I won't tell you which way it divides up. 170 Ireland caps. Glenn Whelan and Richard Dunn. You, whatever way you want, whatever way suits you.
Don't mind.
I was going to do the smart-ass intro, Richard, which is the, you know, 10 own goals and 9 red cards. And what way you divide
so
that up.
You've basically done that.
And I should have actually done it while we were over there, well away from me. Do you laugh about that, or does it really annoy you?
I don't really care. There's not, like...
When you're sitting... Like you're sitting at home on a Sunday watching Sky, relaxing. The family are all there. And somebody scores an own goal, and up pops a little graphic.
Yeah.
And you're like, for fuck's sake.
Yeah, but you get your name on TV, it's all good.
You had to play a lot of games to score that amount of goals.
A lot of the own goals were rubbish, but a lot of them were also because you're trying your hardest to try and be there, be the last man or whatever. And unfortunately, someone has to be in that position, and I was just there too many times, I suppose. But yeah, I don't. It doesn't bother me whatsoever.
We heard from Steve there about the sort of bond and the group of Liverpool players that still get together now, sort of quarter of a century on, if not more. Do you see much of each other? That group of Irish players, the sort of trap era.
No, I wouldn't have said so.
No, I wouldn't have said we had a committee or a group that funds each other. No, we don't. So.
Who'd be the chairman if you did?
Oh, it was Toy. probably Shay. Probably Shay.
Yeah, Shay.
Shay
would love it because it's busy. Yeah, he would love that like that.
He's on everything else, so maybe Shay.
Thing is, with our era, I think a lot of them now are doing TV, so you end up bumping into people the whole time. So if you start organising to meet them as well, then you start seeing too much of them. So you just, enough's enough.
You do go way back, though. You were on the pitch when Glenn made his Manchester City debut. I said earlier that all three of you played for Aston Villa, all three of you played for Manchester City at one period. Yours was a shorter spell maybe than the other two.
Probably about 12 minutes. just the once.
So one game.
One game.
Against TNS. Europe. Total Network Solutions.
European football, yeah. Qualifying. Away? Cardiff. Millennium Stadium. Yeah, there was about 12 people there.
Yeah.
Great game. City were actually 5-0 up from the first leg, so I think that's why we got a run out.
You were there to just shore things up for the last few minutes.
I had to bring Dunny's boots and make sure he had his shin pads and then managed to get a game as well, yeah. So,
what are your memories of a young Glenn Whelan?
He was part of three young Irish lads, was there? Or was it four? Morph,
Paddy.
Stephen Elliott was there.
Willow. Well, yeah. There was a gang of us.
Yeah, there was a load of them.
So Paddy McCarthy, who we would have seen at the weekend, he's assistant manager at Crystal Palace.
Yep.
Picking a fight with the...
No, they were brilliant because they all came over and they were all obviously young lads. And you start to go back to when I was a young lad and what you get up to and stuff like that. So you're looking, but the five of them kept themselves going, they kept themselves, and I think nearly everyone got into the first team, whether they played or they were in the bench or were in the squad. They all worked and got to the levels that were expected. So yeah, they were a well behaved bunch.
Were they?
No.
Go on.
No. My side first. Now there was five of us at the time, and we went over, and obviously the connection with the City U team at the time of Ireland players was really big, but we only had Dunny, who we looked up to try and thrive to be and what he wanted. But now he was like our big brother at the time. He looked after us.
A good role model,
yeah. No, he did. He looked after us day to day and And then when we had to let our hair down, he'd bring us in and take us on his wing as well. So
we all went to the Printworks in Manchester for St. Patrick's Day to celebrate, and I didn't realise actually they were a lot younger than me, so it was a bit weird. But yeah, we had bumped into this Spanish guy, and you're going, this chap can talk a lot, and he was giving us all about how he's not getting on and he wants to leave Man United. And we're going, he's an awful gobshite, he'll never go anywhere. Turns out it's Gerard Piquet, and he made a great career of himself. No, it's just
Kevin Keegan was manager then.
Yeah, when I first went over, Joe Royal was the manager to begin with. And then Joe left, and then Kevin Keegan obviously came in and brought in his staff, and we had a nice coach who came along as well, Stuart Pearce, who looked after us or didn't, who didn't like us. So that was a little bit tough, but yeah.
No. What do you mean he didn't like you?
Oh, well, I think it's the old Irish English thing again, right, isn't it? So I just think obviously Pearcey was still player coach at the time when he first came in, so we were obviously trying to break on the scene, and he was still getting involved in training, and he'd try and leave one or two on you, and unfortunately for him he came across a fella called Willow Flood who upended him and got a giggle, and after that was a big story where now Piercy was coming for us.
Right. And do you think in all seriousness that had an impact on how your career's developed?
Oh, no, not at all. This is their story. This is what we tell each other.
We meet back. He was out to get you.
The true part of it was, yeah, Willow Flood, he was 6 stone, went through on a good day, left Psycho in a half. True story.
Wow. Good man, Willow.
Good man, Willow, yeah. I think
we went to watch the Pogues one night in Manchester, and Stuart Pearce obviously loves all that sort of stuff, so he was in there, and we ended up going backstage, and we walked in backstage, and were you there?
Yep.
Yeah. And I think that was the problem. It shouldn't have all been there. Yeah.
He walks in and Glenn and Jim Gowner are in the corner.
And Willow Flood. So yeah, that might have been the problem.
You obviously played a few more games under Keegan. Like, your list of managers played under...
I got them all sacked.
Perfect. All those own goals and red cards through the years. Like Harry Redknapp, Kevin Keegan, Martin O'Neill, Stuart Pearce, Gerard Houllier, Sven Goran Eriksson, Mark Hughes, Giovanni Trapattoni. Who got the best out of you?
The one that you missed out was Mick McCarthy, who I really liked. Who was brilliant. Who just was dead honest with you and just said, "Listen, you can't be half-arsed through the week. You've got to be 100% to realise that you can play 100% at the weekend." And I think he was the one that made you think that it's not just have a laugh Monday to Friday to prepare and play your best on Saturday. You have to prepare day in, day out, and make sure that you're your best to achieve what you want to do. And he was great. But every single one of them, I think I took a little bit of something out of them. And they're all nice guys, everyone trying their best and trying to be as good as they can, I suppose, for each club. But there isn't one that I look back on and think, well, I didn't learn something from him. So I think that's, I suppose, as a player you go through and you think, well, if we get something from everybody, that's the best you can do.
The half-arsedness, if that's the phrase, was there a moment when things clicked with you?
No, I wasn't. I don't mean it in that way. It was like sometimes you don't tackle people in training because you think, well, we've got a big match the weekend, I don't want to hurt them. And it's like, well, I'm not giving my best every day. And then if I don't tackle them, well, then they don't learn how to move quick enough to get out of the way of it and stuff like that. So I suppose you just start going, right, I can't give 75% on Monday, Tuesday and Wednesday and think I can be 100 on the weekend. So you just start giving it every day. And it's not about the hour and a half on the pitch. It's about a little bit more in terms of your life and the gym and all that stuff. And yeah, it's not the same for everybody. The penny drops straight away. It takes a little bit of time. And it probably took me till I was 23, 24 before I started to get more focused.
So when you came into Ireland camp, would you have been a little bit in awe when you were in the dressing room?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Certainly we had like Niall Quinn, people like that in the squad. I remember playing in Paul McGrath's testimonial and passing the ball to him and then passing it back to me and passing it back to him and he'd pass it back and I went to pass it back and he's going, I can't fucking move. Stop giving me the ball. I was like, all right. But it was just brilliant to be on the same pitch as him and to be around all those people and stuff like that was fantastic. The same as like Steve, who's, I was a Liverpool fan growing up, and he was part of the Liverpool team that I loved and adored. And to go into an Irish team with Niall Quinn, with Steve Staunton, with people like that around the place, you just like, you are a little bit in awe. And it takes a bit of time before you can, I deserve to be here and understand that.
And geez, from the outside, that's so hard to imagine, because my memory of you as a kid was going to like an Ireland under 15 match, a young lad coming up from Mayo and watching underage football. And I think there was a lad we played who was in the squad, and it was Richard Dunn and Jason Gavin were the centre backs. And Jason Gavin had a mustache.
Yeah.
It was under 15. Since that was a proper, 12. proper yeah, mustache. Yeah. And you were about 6'4 at this stage, yeah, and he wasn't far behind you. And it's like, these guys are destined for greatness. They're just at a whole other level.
Yeah, like everything that you get, I think, and you don't expect that, and you just keep getting stuff, and you like, well, if I try hard, and then you're in the reserves, then you're in the next team, then you're in the next team, then you're playing, and all that stuff, and you don't ever think I'm gonna be this or I'm gonna be that or whatever. You just keep trying your best, and then you end up in positions, and people will say, well, how have you done that? And it's like, well, I don't really know. I don't really know, but that's where we've ended up. And it's the same now. It's like, even suppose I do the TV stuff, and I don't even know how I've ended up there, but you just end up keep doing it.
Do you know how you ended up here tonight?
No, this is a mistake somehow.
It was similar for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's obviously you've got a dream of where you want to be. Or like obviously at the time it was FA Cup and Premier League and playing there, but it was only ever a dream. So you used to try as hard as you could, and you'd play for the, like for me it was like 16s, then 18s, then reserve football, and right enough you're in around the first team by hook or by crook. Like, but I just think for us, I think as Irish people, we just keep our head down and just work hard and don't really expect anything, which is probably a little bit different than probably a little bit, man, we should be more entitled to go and have bigger dreams and expect the best. But I think like what Rich says, it's like if you get it, you just go, oh, delighted, what's next type of thing. So
do you reflect then, now that you're retired and you're gone into the coaching side and your career, and say 10 years with Stoke in the Premier League, you know, closing in on 300 appearances in the Premier League, like one of the great Irish careers, and that time at Stoke where, you know, they're spending lots of money to replace you all the time. Actually, should you have had your chest out a little bit more?
Well, I think I had to, because it was probably being replaced most of the time when players were coming in, was to try and be, to get someone better than myself. So, yeah, just seeing that as just a chance to keep my head down and go, I've worked too hard to get here, I'm not giving it up. So if anyone that comes in and wants to be better, then I'm going to have to try and do something different to take the jersey off them, or they have to do something different to get the jersey off me. So I think for me, it was always trying to prove people wrong more than being there and being this big footballer or professional footballer, what everyone says. So I think that was more my mentality.
But when you're going through that, and I presume you had a very good relationship with Tony Pulis, considering how long you worked together, and he's gone out and, you know, he's signing, was it Stephen Nzonzi came in 1 year, Imbula was the big one where it was about 25 million and obviously didn't work out. Like, are you into his office the day after that going, listen, I'm going to fight for my life here, or how does that work?
Yeah, no, you were knocking on the door and seeing where you stood, but it was a case of, as long as I had a fair fight for my spot, then I was more than willing to stay and fight for the jersey. But I also had opportunities myself to leave, and those other teams that came in. But I think at the time, Stoke was my team, and I'd been there when you were in the Championship, and what we'd worked for, and quite a few of the lads, and we took it on ourselves as like we were Stoke people, even though we weren't. Stoke people had never seen top flight before, and now we were trying to do the best for them, and obviously ourselves and our family. But we took it to heart a little bit more than Johnny Fordner, who was coming in for X, Y, and Z. So,
yeah.
You liked the cold Tuesday nights?
Well, you weren't that cold. It was only cold when teams didn't beat us, because the sun was out, or not to be certain opposition, you'd only ever heard of it wasn't grey, because more or less they lost the game. It was always okay on a Tuesday when they won a game.
Yeah.
It was only ever when.
But it's a great thing, I'd imagine, as a group to have developed that almost reputation of this place is going to be a bloody nightmare to go to.
Yeah, it was siege mentality. It was something that we had up our sleeve because commentators or people outside Stoke would mention it. So we knew we had something on top of opposition that were coming on a Tuesday night or a Wednesday night, whatever it might be.
Horrible on a Saturday evening. Worst days to go.
Yeah?
Yeah, it was awful. Because it's just open, isn't it? All the corners and stuff like that. And it was just horrible.
The wind to be whipping.
Even in the sun, it was windy. And it was just, yeah, it was a horrible, hard place to go.
But it was, and that's what we loved about it, because we knew we had one up on most teams that were coming there at the time.
Why were you looking at me when you said commentators have been critical? I never said anything.
Not you, personally. But yeah.
But that criticism that you took, like, how did you get that balance of driving you on in your career and not letting it bog you down? Because particularly at times during Ireland, it was quite heavy.
Personally?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's part and parcel of the game. You have good games, you have bad games, but the only one that I was ever trying to prove right or wrong was my family and friends, people that were close to me. So I know it was tough at times, but it was never that tough.
Right.
I'm a footballer.
Yeah.
Steve said it's only a game, so I never took it to heart, or it was never going to be too tough on top of me because I play football.
Right, because I always remember covering a few Stoke games and chatting to the journalists over in Stoke, and they would rave about you. Like, your character as a guy, you come out after the games and chat to them. I remember it was Newcastle against Stoke. It was a scoreless draw up in St James's Park in the middle of winter. Not the greatest game we've ever seen. And you spent about half an hour chatting to all the Stoke journalists and, we're happy to analyse the game. And it came to talking to me. And the second the Irish action started, I could tell your face sort of changed, almost of there's something else going on here. And I didn't take it personally, but it felt, maybe I should have taken it personally.
Yeah. I don't know you, but you've just got one of them faces.
That's totally understandable. Totally understandable. I walked straight into that one now. No. But what was there, the criticism around Ireland was so severe.
There was, we're going into something. No, there was something that happened and I got a little bit personal and I've just gone, well, I don't need Irish press because I'm playing in Stoke. The only thing we need from Ireland was to impress the manager, the coaches and the players that I played with, and that's all I thought about.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you want to talk about it, but obviously it's the Dunphy line about the Ferrari and that. How, like, it feels like it's so not you. Is that what made it more difficult?
Well, you got the car wrong to begin with. It wasn't a Ferrari. It was a Toyota. No, like I said, listen, Eamon does what he has to do because it's headlines, and we've got the new Richard Dunphy now on the sides. He's going to be doing the same as well. No, it was never that. I think when the actual headline was brought up about where it was from and then the cars that it was driving, and then I thought, wow, that's a little bit touchy.
Yeah.
And then I've got two kids. My daughter was getting a little bit older, and then she was obviously headlines and starting to read it as well. So got to a stage where it's gone, enough's enough.
But it's also like, you're playing 90 times for your country. Like, this is the dream. Like, you're doing the thing that when you are 14, 15, like, this is where you want to be. This isn't what you expect people to be saying about you.
No, listen, you can take it. Like what I said, you have good games, you have bad games, you've got results that don't go for you. But I felt like I was the scapegoat at times for a period. Now, listen, I'm not crying here. The only people that I was trying to impress was obviously the managers, and to be honest with you, it was making sure Rich was okay with me, Robbie was okay with me, John and Kev and whoever it was. That's all I was worried about. As long as we were doing okay or trying our best, then I wasn't worried about what was said in headlines. And the older I got, the more I preferred it, because if it was me, it wasn't someone else or some of the young lads, the way probably Rich would have taken it for when he was getting older to the young lads coming through. So it's part and parcel of football.
And it was Keith Andrews who was letting you down the whole time anyways.
It was Keith, yeah. And Xavi and Iniesta. And that Spain midfield still have nightmares now, yeah.
Yeah?
Nightmares.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
The toughest game you ever played?
Yeah. It was the toughest day.
Yeah.
And night and week I've ever had, yeah. No, they were great. three cheers for Spain.
You're obviously by then one of the more experienced members of the squad, and it, like, now we look back at these times as the glory days, it turns out. Like, how did you feel when you were seeing some of the criticism that was coming on the team around the trap era?
There was an agenda, I think, against certain people. I mean, I remember we went to, we went to the boxing or something like that, and the cricket team walked in, they announced, oh, the cricket team's here, and everyone went, wee, and then the Gaelic team was there, the rugby team was there, and everyone got cheered, and then the Irish team come in, like, boo, and everyone booed us, and it was like, because everything in the media had been negative about Ireland, because the football wasn't what they were seeing in England, it wasn't the expectations and stuff like that, but I think when you're a footballer and you're honest with yourself, you know your limitations, you know what you're good at. So I could do certain things, Glenn could do certain things, but there's different things that Messi can do and all that stuff, and they've got it all. We made the most of what we had. We gave everything. We fought for everything that we earned, I suppose. But people expected more from us all the time because we played in the Premier League. But we weren't amazing. We were just hard-working people, and we've got, like, limitations to our actual ability, and it wasn't appreciated for a while, and it's like, well, you shouldn't be qualifying because you can defend corners or all that stuff, and it was tough to take because we hadn't changed as players, we hadn't changed the people, but we were getting criticised for not beating teams 5-0 or 4-0, which Ireland never does. So yeah, it's almost like take the same thing as what Damien Duff's doing now. Everyone's against us, let's all come together, group together and focus and try and come together as a unit, try and qualify, and eventually we got the best out of what we had, I suppose, in the squad.
Trap ever in the trench coat?
No. I remember Trap actually threatened to leave after the first game, I think, didn't he?
That was your debut, was it?
Yeah. Was it your fault?
Yeah, your fault again.
Because he came down with a newspaper at 2 o'clock in the morning, like an old person would, trying to swat a fly. He came down and he put a newspaper, and he had the whole team was just down drinking and playing guitar. And he's like, "This is not professional. This is not professional." And we're like, "Yeah, but we won, so it's grand."
Trap obviously loved you though. Like, so your debut was his first game in charge, and like the entire way through, you were there. It felt like first name on the team sheet.
Yeah. Now whatever it was, we ended up going to a training camp beforehand. I think when he was announced, we had a 2-week training camp in Spain, and it was sort of my chance to go and show what I could do. And we didn't even have a game, I think it was just training, and something happened. And there was, to be fair, it was on the back of Stoke being promoted and got to the Premier League and playing. So I think it was a case of, at the time, a lot of the group mainly was playing in the Premier League, where it's a little bit different now. But yeah, for wherever it was, I remember. Now, Keith would tell you if he was here, it was like a case of, I used to be box to box until Pulis got hold of me and then Trapattoni. I used to scratch, he scored a few goals. Use young lads, check it out. I have a few decent ones. And then it was a sort of a scenario or a way of playing, and you've obviously, people have talked to McAlealy, like the holding midfield or a number six or four, whatever you call it now. And I could do it, and he wanted that because of the Italian way. But Keith was scoring goals, and Keith probably had a little bit more legs. So Keith was given license to get forward. But then I'd say to Keith, "You stay, I'll go." And Keith was like, "No, you stay, I'm going." And I got to the stage where Trap and Marco was like, "No, you stay, Keith can go, James can go." So everyone else was allowed to go, but I had to stay. So I was holding Rich's hand, more or less.
Keith just stayed anyway, didn't he?
Well, whatever it was, I was more babysitting and wasn't allowed to go anywhere, so... But listen, again, that's what Trap wanted. I think there was at one stage we went 13 games unbeaten, and the Ireland team was getting slated because we didn't score X amount of goals, but we'd been unbeaten in 13. So I think you'd snap your hand off for that now.
Yeah, putting it mildly. Did that bring you closer together, the criticism? Like, was there that, as you say, siege mentality aspect of it, or were there people within the camp going, well, actually, maybe we could do more. Maybe we could play a different style of football.
Don't think so, is that?
Well, I get like what people are saying, style of football, but when you actually look at the players that we had, like, it wasn't a case of we've gone 10 defenders and just sit in. We had like Duff, McGeady, obviously Robbie, like we had talent out there. I think it was just a case of the Italian way, like anything, what the manager wants, you have to try and give, because if you don't give it, you're not getting selected. It was never spoken about in the dressing room about, like, oh, the press don't like us, or like, all we wanted was to qualify and get the playoffs or get to the Euros, and we managed to do it. So
the thing is with Trap as well, we used to come in, say, on a Monday for a Saturday game or a Friday night game, and on Monday you would train for 25 minutes on throw-ins, because he lost the UEFA Cup final in 1984 on a throw-in. So we would have to pay for it all the time, doubling up either side, set pieces and all that stuff. And it's like, oh, we're doing this again, we're doing this again. But we didn't concede goals, like you're saying, until we got to the Euros, and then we couldn't stop conceding.
Was he the best defensive coach you had?
Probably, yeah. I think himself and Marco Tardelli were just, he used to speak about the detail, but he used to give us the detail as well, which told us exactly what position. So we would go down to Malahide and do our set pieces on the morning of the game, and he would literally drag you from, right, no, not there, there, one inch, there, this and this and this. And we'd all know to an absolute T what was expected of us. And I think he was, when you work with certain coaches, and probably the same with Pulis and stuff, you go back a little bit of time and it's about, come on lads, go, fight, 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 fight. Where now you see coaches about tactical details and all that stuff, and he had them. He understood what it took and what position, and it wasn't okay to be there, you were better to be here. So I think as a defensive point he was brilliant, but I would imagine if you asked Robbie or Damien or anything like that, he certainly didn't restrict them in what they could do going forward. It was just, in international football, sometimes you're playing really good teams and you just can't get out, or you can't be at the attacking force you want to be.
Yeah, ironically, maybe Pep is more restrictive with his wingers than Trapattoni was with our wingers.
100%, yeah, I would imagine so. I think the way you must keep the ball, I think once we got over the halfway line and it was like, right, well, don't turn back, just go and see what he can do. And I think that was one of the strengths of Trapattoni, was he never looked at us as an attacking force going, we need to keep possession. It's like, fucking hell, if you're in there half, you might as well have a shot, have a goal. So that was the way it was.
We did get to a playoff, of course, and you mentioned your goal-scoring prowess. Maybe the time to have a little bit of a look at one of the great Irish goals, we're going to say. Crow Park.
Shank and silly.
No, here. We've got the pundit in the room. Let's see what Richard Dunn has to say about it. Oh, there he is. A distraction. Liam Lawrence with the free kick. Oh. Woo! Straight off the training ground.
7 minutes.
Was it?
Not the first time we've seen him do that.
No.
Pass off the shin pad, that, yeah.
Just like that against Georgia, and he's done it again.
Well, this is it. Obviously, Richard said the same thing. It's straight off the trainer pitch. It wasn't. Straight off the cuff. that's what happened. Obviously, I had a relationship with Liam at Stoke. We actually see bobbled one in.
Yeah.
And then we've bobbled it back.
Well, now we'll see. Now we'll get the right angle. He's come
onto a beautiful. It's mad because nowadays everything is off the training ground. Everything is stuck to a structure, and people don't take responsibility upon themselves. Whereas, like, we're probably told, whip that ball in the box, but the opportunity comes.
I think it's actually Keith goes out. If the start of that, Keith goes and speaks to Liam, because the Italian way, they obviously bring 11 men back, 10 men back with the keeper, and they're in a straight line, and Keith's gone, you're free on the edge of the box. So he's gone out to Liam and gone, pull it back. So it wasn't a training ground situation. It was literally just a case of the Italians are doing the Italian thing. Let's try something.
And you knew what the Italians were going to do.
Well, yeah, because we were doing it.
Yeah. Someone just said they're like, amazing. Like, you can even hear there in the background the noise at Crow Park that day as the ole ole's start ringing out. Like, we look at this current group, they're not having those sort of moments. Like, that night, like, when that goal goes in, when we think we're going to win the game late on and we get the goal again, like, those nights are, wow, like, so, so special.
Yeah, well, I think that's just over the years, and especially, obviously, played and being a fan first and foremost, was like, we've had them over the years. We've always turned up against the big teams or the so-called big nations. In my time, obviously, Germany, Italy, you go back to beforehand with Holland and stuff. I don't know, whatever it is, it's like when a big team's coming into town, Now we showed up, and unfortunately over the last couple of years it's just not quite happened.
So what happens next then after that game against Italy, and we go into the playoff against France? You throw off the shackles in the second leg, is the common understanding of what happened that night, that you'd had enough of Trapp and the Italian way and the defensive style, and you're like, no, we're going to go for this. Is that what happened?
Pretty much, yeah. But it wasn't the thing against Trapp. It was just the things like, he wanted to be as cautious as he always was, and the cautiousness has got a really long distance. It done really well for us, so I don't think we all of a sudden turned and thought, oh, he hasn't got a clue.
So how does it happen then?
We just got on the bus and just thought, you know what? It's not a night for sitting back. We've got nothing to lose. We've already probably messed up in the Croke Park game when we got beat 1-0, and it's like there's no point in waiting and hoping. You might as well try and take it into your own hands and go for it. And that was the case of it. And I just think we pressed them really high up the pitch.
I think it was a case of
kick it long.
The actual pressing game, it was one of them. Obviously, with the strikers, if Robbie was going, that me and Keith were making sure we'd be behind them, and then obviously Rich and everyone else behind us. So I think it was just a case of, now we're going to see what these have got. Again, it wasn't a fingers up to Trapp. It was a case of, now we're losing here. Like, we need to get results. Like, drawing's not going to be good enough. We need to go and do something. And obviously, we scored a decent goal, and got us into good stead to begin with anyway.
It's taking responsibility. I think so often now you're looking at players, and every time anything goes wrong, they're like, oh, what's the manager telling us to do? And going back, and I'm sure even more so when Steve was playing, it was like, players have to take the responsibility themselves and understand it's them on the pitch that have stuff to do. So we tried to do it, and we thought, well, if they kick it long, there's no way fucking Henri wants to head it. So we should win the header, and then we can go again and start again. And we were pressing them high, and it was working for the majority of the game.
And you were right, he didn't want to head it.
He wanted to handle it.
While Richard was consoling Thierry after the game and for all the criticism he was going to get, what was your reaction?
Yeah, no, it was devastation. I'd come off at the time, so I wasn't on the pitch when it happened, but I think because it was off and it was close to screens and you could see what happened, they are at him, like, obviously we've got Farr now, was one of them, please, like, just make it go to penos and give us half a chance. And that was devastation, because at the time I'm off the pitch, I'm now a fan, and you're wanting to get to a World Cup, so it was tough to take. But listen, don't get me wrong, if it was the other way around, I'd do what Thierry done. I would handle ball, whatever I had to do to get there. So now he had to do what was right for his team, and now we do the same if it was in air court.
How long does it take you to get to that realisation?
Oh, well, I don't speak to any French people now, and I don't like people. I actually don't. Oh, yeah. So I've taken it to heart now, yeah. That don't like the French.
Yeah.
I moved there, which is a fucking strange thing. And then I ended up having a row with an under-9s coach at a game over in France, who was saying, Thierry Henry. And I was like, it's fucking 15 years ago, Luke. I don't really care. And
it's an under-9 game.
Yeah, yeah. Is it the lads play? But yeah.
Had you anything to throw back at them?
I couldn't speak French at the time, so it was annoying me, yeah.
You spoke about the Spain game at Euro 2012 and just how good they were. This is your second major tournament, so you're at the World Cup in 2002, and obviously a very idyllic, serene time had been had at that one, and you were hoping maybe for something similar in 2012. How soon into the tournament do you realise we're in a spot of honour here?
We're in trouble, yeah.
I knew we were in trouble early, because Rich won't tell you, Rich was struggling with an injury beforehand with his shoulder, a groin, Shea was shoulder, so our two biggest talisman were struggling and didn't play loads of football leading up to that. So now, if anything was going to go well for us, we needed our strongest players, and unfortunately at the time the two of them were struggling and patching themselves together. So now they call it the group of death, and now it definitely was, because when you look what Croatia, obviously Italy and then Spain, now right enough Spain went to beat Italy in the final 4-0, so if they could do that to the finalists, obviously it was difficult. But I think for us at the time it was sort of coming to the end with Trapp, because we knew then that was a tough gig with the 4-4-2 and two wingers, and because the Spain game, like for me, like I said, it's nightmare stuff.
Could you describe what, like, you're going up against maybe the best midfield of all time? Like, when you're half an hour into that game, like, what are you thinking?
Half an hour? The warm-up.
The
team sheets came in and David Silva, Fabregas, Juan Mata were only on the bench. They couldn't get in. And we were going 4-4-2. I was going, wow, let's go 5-5-6 or whatever we can do.
5-5-6.
Whatever. Listen, I was delighted to be on the pitch with them in the right way, but in the wrong way, I wish I was sick.
You were sick by the end of it.
Well, yeah.
That was shit. It was really shit. Because you're like, you've reached a level of football where you think, right, we're capable of competing against the best. And then you're not. Yeah, and you're not. And you're miles off. And you think, I can't do any more here to just try and survive on this pitch for the next half an hour or whatever that. And fair play, because the fans were singing, they were having a great time. But we were literally crying on the pitch, just going, please end this. Because it was a massacre, wasn't it?
Yeah.
We couldn't get the ball. We couldn't do that. We couldn't. Even like, I tried to start the fight with Ramos and he didn't even want to fight. So there you go, what the hell? So it's just near impossible, that whole thing.
Wait. I actually think they took the foot off the gas, you know. Mm. I think it was, once it came 4-0, it was like, conserve an energy, make a few subs, keep ball. And we were like, on you go, lads. As long as it's away from your goal, do what you just want.
Leave us alone.
Yeah.
It was tough.
Have we found out who's playing you in the Saipan movie?
No idea. Do you know what? That's, again, there's lots of stuff that I don't care about, but that's another one. That's the least interesting thing. Because, you know, when you've lived it and you've answered questions over for so much time, you think, how has Steve Coogan gone and made a film about that? Why has he done that? Bizarre.
You're the only person who finds it boring.
Surely someone else does, yeah. Surely. I mean, I don't really understand what more can be said about it.
Well, David Connolly has the tapes.
Yeah.
So we'll find out the truth. Who was right? Mick or Roy?
Well, the truth is, what everyone has said is, we went to Saipan for a bit of R&R, or whatever they called it, and it was that was it. And they asked to try in, and we didn't have any balls, we didn't have any kit, and then they ended up sticking down coats and all that stuff. And yeah, it was just, it wasn't ideal, but it wasn't planned, so it wasn't anyone's mistake. It was just Roy expected more, and which is fair enough, and they fell out.
You're not much of a script writer. You know?
Yeah, make a film out of it if you want, but yeah. I mean, it's not, it is a huge thing. I think as well, everything is, when you're involved in something, it's a moment, isn't it? It happens and it goes and then it comes again or whatever like that. But when you're outside and you want to know more, it becomes a story for like 25 years, 30 years, and it's like,
nobody wants to hear your, that was pretty boring actually. Nobody wants to hear that story at all.
Yeah.
Just make something up and add to it.
Watch the film and then decide.
That's what we do. We get you to review the film.
You review it and tell me, oh, that was brilliant. Or that was, actually, yeah, it was boring.
All right, we'll go together. Nice little date night. You had that night in Lille. How special was that?
Yeah, and I'll, again, going back to,
after what had happened, say, at Euro 2012, to have that moment that, you know, now again, sort of, where are we, 9 years on? We sort of wonder when it'll ever happen. We had, you know, Robbie's goal, we had Ibaraki. You know, every generation has had something. And that Robbie Brady moment is one that I think, for certainly people of my generation, will live forever.
Yeah, it was the same sort of thing when you look at the group that we had with Sweden, Belgium, and then obviously the Italians again. It was difficult for us to come out. I think for the lads who were in the 2016 squad, we were just hoping, like, get a win, get a result, do the fans proud, do our families proud, whatever it was, just so we could escape from 2012 a little bit. So, yeah, obviously, on the night was unbelievable with Robbie, and obviously getting the winner like he did near the end to qualify and get out of the group was unbelievable. And even then, like what Rich says, their players were coming over, the fans, if you're winning or losing, they're singing, no matter what's happening. And the Italians were coming over to us, and they just couldn't believe how loud the Irish people were at that time. And now, for us, that just sums everything up. I take what happened in 2012 to be able to live what happened in 2016. Yeah, definitely.